21-1662 Adams v. United States. Ms. Elkin, please proceed.
Thank you, Chief Judge, and may it please this giant court. Thank you for your interest in this important case. Convening en banc, sua sponte, in a case where a panel decision did not issue, it's unusual. It's uncommon. It's out of the ordinary. It's happened maybe two or three times in the last 25 years. And as unusual as it is nowhere as unusual as the once-in-a-century global pandemic that shut the world down and sent us to our basement to wait out the storm. Like most of the workforce, the federal workforce, we got to work from home. We got to isolate in our pods. We got to do oral arguments via Zoom. We got to do everything in our power to stay safe and to stay alive. But not my clients. Not these first responders, not these brave 180-plus correctional officers at FCI Danbury, who are in this court seeking hazardous duty pay, the duty pay that Congress intended for them, for this kind of situation where they worked under unusually hazardous conditions. They did not get to wait out the storm. They went headfirst into the unprecedented storm.
Just out of curiosity, counsel. My very first act as chief judge was to issue an administrative order making all Federal Circuit employees come back to work. This was quite a while ago and relatively early in the stage of what you refer to as the pandemic. Are all of these employees, every one of them, likewise entitled to hazardous duty pay? Is that what Congress also intended?
No, Your Honor. Congress.
Why not?
Well, I don't know when your order issued, but our case has limitations on it. It has limitations for temporal limitations as well as occupational limitations. And so Congress intended for it to apply to unusual hazards.
And you think Congress intended it to apply in some temporal or occupational context?
Yes, because of the way that the statute is written and the way that the regulations are written, absolutely. And the Congress...
Well, you know, Congress doesn't write the regulations, right?
Right, but the OPM, OPM was given the authority to write these regulations.
Could I be clear? Are you relying solely on the regulations? You're saying that your clients fit within the regulations, or are you separately also relying on the statute?
We're relying on both, Your Honor, because the statute applies to unusual hazards and working under unusually hazardous conditions. And that's exactly what we have here. COVID-19, without doubt.
So you're saying that even if we were to conclude that you haven't brought yourself within the regulations, that you can still argue for recovery under the statute, even if the regulations are inapplicable?
I don't think we're saying that at all, Your Honor. I think we fall squarely within both the statute and within the regulations themselves.
Okay, so is the answer that if you can't bring yourself within the regulations, you lose?
Yes, that is the answer, because OPM was delegated the authority to put these regulations out, and they put out a regulation that says that if you are working with or in close proximity to a virulent biological or a microorganism, then you are entitled to hazardous duty pay or environmental differential pay. We think the regulations should be given the Chevron deference that they deserve. They're clear on their face.
Regulations don't get Chevron deference, counsel. They get our deference.
Well, they should be given the deference that they deserve, which is that our clients went into this unprecedented storm where the airborne virulent biologicals and the microorganisms were raining down on them, and they did. Yes.
What are the temporal limitations? You alluded to some. What are they specifically?
Okay, specifically, the temporal limitations are twofold. One is that we have to prove on a day-by-day basis that the workers were working with or in close proximity to virulent biologicals. And we will be able to do that in this case because the Bureau of Prisons, you can look on the internet after this argument, they put out a COVID-19 dashboard. And in that dashboard, it says on a day-by-day basis how many inmates
well,
have COVID.
What about in the intervening period? People started wearing masks. Everyone was wearing masks. After that, people were getting vaccinated. So pretty much everybody, but not everybody. So do we calculate who was vaccinated and who wasn't? How do we ever implement something like that?
The way it is implemented, Judge, is that the temporal proximity is twofold. One is on a day-by-day basis. The other one is when the vaccines came out. When there were vaccines, then the hazard, we don't meet the regulation anymore because the hazard is no longer something if the virulent biological...
Well, wait, you said when the vaccines came out, you have to figure out whether the people that are at stake had the vaccines, right?
That's a more accurate way to say it. It's not when they came out, it's when they became readily available to the correctional officers. And that's easy to figure out once we're in discovery. That's a discovery question. But once the vaccines were readily...
One interesting thing about this is you never answered my original question, which is why doesn't it apply to every federal worker who was ordered back to work under those circumstances?
Because this case is not about every federal worker. I mean, the government would like you to think that the sky is falling. It's not. There's not going to be opening up the floodgates. The only gate that should open is the latch on this Rule 8 gate because we've met our burden. Every federal worker had your office, your clerks. They could come in. They could be in an office. They could be able to socially distance. They could have good ventilation. They could pop open a window. My clients couldn't do that.
Counsel, you refer to virulent biologicals, which are in the regulation. Viruses in petri dishes? Were these workers working with live viruses? Isn't that what virulent biologicals refers to?
Your Honor, it doesn't have that kind of limitation in the regulation at all. The regulation simply says that you work with...
These are possibly potentially sick people. And those are not really biological.
That's how the virus was spread, was through a human person who had the virus. We carried the virus, we shedded the virus, we contaminated other people with the virus. There's nothing in the regulation or the statutes that say that you have to work in a lab. And in fact, that's the scientist rule that the government advances.
What about the examples in the environmental differential pay category for microorganisms? It's pretty clear that they're talking about containers holding these microorganisms for high degree hazards, and then the low degree hazards is contrasted by saying, well, you don't, to qualify for a low degree hazard, you don't have to have direct contact with those primary containers. So those examples, plus the other examples in the now retired personnel manual of explaining what virulent biologicals are for the hazard duty pay, shouldn't we take something from these examples? Maybe they're not limiting, of course, but they're thematically underscoring, I think, the point Judge Lori was making.
Your Honor, as you point out, the examples, the only place examples exist are in the high degree environmental differential pay regulation. You're not supposed to leapfrog over the statute and the regulations definitions themselves to go to the examples first. But to the extent that you go to the examples first, we believe that humans are primary containers of the virulent biological COVID-19, and the only non-exhaustive, two examples that you have in that regulation, we fit within it because it talks about individuals being in direct contact with primary containers of organisms pathogenic for man, such as culture flasks, culture test tubes, hypodermic syringes, and similar instruments, and biopsy and autopsy material. Well, where do you think that comes from? I mean, an autopsy, I guess, is a dead person, but a biopsy material comes from a human. So I think you can make an argument.
I suppose that was the government's point in their red brief when they said, sure, any officer, correctional officer, or other person in a correctional facility that's getting biopsies from people with these microorganisms, they would probably qualify for pay, but extra pay, but not if you're just doing the regular assigned duty where you're exposed in that environment to all sorts of communicable diseases.
And Your Honor, I would submit that example, the lone example that they gave in their brief, really indicates exactly why we should win and why we should have our day in court. Because the example they gave was that, they tried to come up with one, and the only example they could come up was someone who is a federal employee, if the federal employee were assigned the duty of collecting biological samples from prison inmates to test for communicable disease that meets the definition of virulent biological, that person might satisfy the requirement of HDP. Who?
Didn't OPM already answer that question in the guidance that they put out? And I'm looking at the guidance on its U.S. Office of Personnel Management, questions and answers on human resources flexibilities and authority for coronavirus 2019, COVID-19. This was attached and incorporated by reference to appellant's complaint. And under page 11G, the question is hazardous pay related to exposure to COVID-19. The question is, and this is a guidance, may an employee receive hazard pay differentials or environmental differentials pay if exposed to COVID-19 through the performance of assigned duties? That question is more direct than the other examples that are presented in the retired guidance. And then it goes on and actually answers that question in the affirmative, especially with its view that what happens when materials of microorganic nature are introduced into the human body. Does this guidance apply, and if so, how?
Your Honor, absolutely it does. OPM went through the trouble of issuing this memorandum at the beginning of the pandemic. And in the memorandum, it talks about, it actually defines biological as a severe acute respiratory syndrome, and it's a quarantinable communicable disease. It gives guidance on people taking leave, and it gives guidance on paying employees, federal employees,
and
hazardous duty pay.
That disease is communicable from what, a Petri dish?
Your Honor, it's communicable from a person to a person. That's how we spread it. And OPM knew enough to issue this guidance to the entire federal workforce. It wasn't just issued to the scientists and the people in the labs who were working with test tubes of perhaps virulent biologicals. It went to the entire workforce.
Counsel, can I just go back to the chief's question? In any given office throughout the government, there are going to be people, or at least at one time, there were people who were in close proximity to sources of the virus, namely other people. How is it that you can say that a suit by basically any such people, and assume now that the risk remained substantial during a period, maybe pre-vaccine, maybe pre-mask, maybe even after vaccine, you're trying to, I think, give comfort that those suits would obviously go away, and I'm not seeing why.
Okay. Your Honor, the reason those suits would go away is because you have to look to the job duties. You have to look to what the employee is supposed to do. And
you have to be in the office. There are other disease vectors walking around.
It's their job is not to be proximate with the other office workers. Their job is not to be...
If they have to be in the office?
If they...
That's part of their job duty.
But their job is different from what the prison guards were doing. What they have to do is hands-on work. Their whole job is to...
You didn't allege any of that in your complaint, counsel. None of that's in the complaint. You want to survive a motion to dismiss your complaint, but where is all of this evidence that differentiates your job, or as you suggested in response to my question, ventilation or other things? Where does that appear grounded in your complaint?
Your Honor, we say in our complaint they had to work with or in close proximity to infected individual services, et cetera.
But that's true for, like Judge Toronto said, for people who came back here too.
And what we said in our briefs to you in response to our questions is if you want us to redraft our complaint.
What would you put in the amended complaint? Forget about the technical pleading. I want to understand what the substantive distinction is if you're saying that a human source, a living human source, can be the source of the danger. You know, what are the standards that take, as I think you're trying to suggest, even at the Rule 12 stage, the normal federal office worker out of that?
Okay. The types of things that we put into the complaints that we did amend, and we point this out on docket 41 at page 44, that plaintiffs are charged with the principal and primary duty of maintaining the safety of the institution in significant part by coming into close physical proximity with inmates and other correctional officers, The posts that they've been assigned to within the institution involve prolonged, close quarter exposure to coworkers and inmates, often indoor and in closed settings.
Yeah, but so, I mean, what you said so far sounds like, I don't know, a very large part of the federal workforce.
But, Your Honor, most...
These are office jobs.
Most of the federal workforce went home during the height of the pandemic. And to the extent they came back, they did have safety measures. You could be in an office. The last time I had an argument here, there was plastic everywhere.
So is your view that anybody that didn't go home and by nature of their work would come into contact with other people gets hazardous duty pay?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
Because your job has to be one.
So what if you have a maintenance team that goes around maintaining buildings or roads or other types of equipment, and they work in teams of two or three or five, and they have to be there physically present. They're there together. They're traveling together. Does your definition exclude those people?
It does, actually, because...
How?
To the extent it has to be part of your job, and the plaintiffs have to show that they worked with somebody who had an infection. That's number one. So I don't know that, you know, the rules
I'm sorry, that doesn't seem at all responsive to my question when I said these are people that work maintenance jobs, that work in teams and travel together. Did I have to assume that there was a great risk for infection in the early stages when these people didn't have the vaccine? I mean, if you're working routinely with people that are out in the world and not isolating, there was a great risk of exposure.
There was a great risk of exposure, Judge. But we would have to, as plaintiffs, be able to prove that we came into contact and a part of our job.
But if you could prove that you came into contact, those people would be covered, right?
No, contact with an infected individual or an infectious individual. Just by virtue of just working next to Reed over here doesn't give me the hazardous duty pay. I have to be able to prove that I came into
contact. But any federal worker that was working in person with other people that was exposed to one person that had COVID gets hazardous duty pay.
Your Honor, as long their job has to be one where they have to come into physical contact. Just because
you're
working.
Your point is that most federal workers can socially distance from the people they're working with, whereas your allegations is that the guards couldn't. They had to get in contact with these people to restrain them, to handcuff them, to push them around. It was a different job.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
But the problem that I see, okay, is that you may have a good argument that these people should be covered, but isn't the proper remedy to go to OPM and say, we have a new virus, a new situation here, and some of these workers are particularly likely to get it because of the nature of their jobs. Why don't you amend the regulations to create a new category to cover them? Why isn't that the appropriate approach?
Well, Your Honor, OPM already has a regulation on the books, and that regulation applies to the workers that I'm talking
about.
There's
a lot of skepticism as to whether that regulation could properly be read to cover your situation, but what's the answer to my question? Couldn't you go to OPM and say the regulation needs to be expanded to cover this new situation?
I suppose we could, but we don't have any authority to do so. The remedy is already on the statutes, and it's already in the regulations themselves, and this court has tools.
Anybody can ask an agency to change regulations, right?
I would imagine, but I don't think we need to do that here.
If I remember right, at least in the panel brief on page 2, the red brief, that is the government's brief, the government acknowledged that OPM could, in fact, amend the regulation to address COVID-19.
Your Honor, it could amend it, but Judge...
Sorry, and I would say I can't right now think of any reason it couldn't do so retroactively because the only one burdened would be the government.
Your Honor, as Judge Reyna pointed out, even OPM thought that these workers out there who are working with COVID-19, inmates infected with COVID-19, no difference between an inmate infected with COVID-19 and a vial that has COVID-19 in it. There's no difference. In fact, it is more dangerous for the correctional officers to work with these infected inmates than it is for somebody working in a sterile lab with a virulent biological. The beaker has no legs. The beaker cannot walk across the room and breathe on you.
And just to be clear, let's go back to this, to the guidance that OPM, we're talking about OPM regulations. Here's a guidance from OPM itself, the agency, And it answers this question that you're being asked, and it says an employee may not receive hazardous pay differential under the virulent biologicals category if an exposure to qualifying virus was not triggered by the performance of assigned duties. Now, here's a scenario. You got two guards that work at a correctional facility. One guard shows up to work, punches his card in, goes up to a watchtower and sits there and monitors what's going on down at the yard and everything. The other correctional officer goes into the building and his job is to strip search prisoners after they come back in from their recreational time to look for weapons or drugs or paraphernalia. So is your argument is what you're saying is that the latter correctional guard may be entitled to hazardous duty pay, while the former would have to prove that sitting up on the watchtower, they're entitled to hazardous pay.
Your Honor, I think that's right. I think the guard in the watchtower are the clerks that came back to Chief Judge Moore's chambers. They're going to be a lot more pressed to prove that they came into close proximity with the virulent biological than the correctional officers who's
so
everyday.
Even as a judge, if I wanted to hazardous pay and I said, well, I worked with other judges and we were faced with the public, I would still have to show that the performance of my duties, my job duties, put me in this close proximity and that the qualifying virus was triggered by the performance of those assigned duties.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And we believe that we have stated a claim that the correctional officers have those exact job duties that would put them in close proximity to the virulent biological and the microorganism because of the nature of the work.
And this guidance was attached to your complaint.
Sorry?
This guidance was made part of your complaint.
I believe it was.
Okay.
Counsel, I just wanted to ask two questions. One was, you talked about temporal limitations. But by referring to temporal limitations other than like when the risk started and when it ended, are you saying that for each individual member of the plaintiff's group, each one of them has to identify on which days they were exposed to somebody who tested positive for COVID?
Yes.
Okay, and then second question is, was the Bureau of Prisons asked for hazard pay? Did anybody go to the Bureau of Prisons, like under Section 5 CFR 550.904, and ask for hazard pay?
Not that I know of, Your Honor.
Okay.
These correctional officers have come into this court asking to be paid this pay that was intended for them by Congress and by these OPM regulations as written. And to further answer the question about how do you limit this, you have the tools at your disposal to limit it. The United States Supreme Court, as the amicus AFL-CIO pointed out in National Federation of Independent Businesses versus DOL, the U.S. Supreme Court recognizes that workplaces are not all the same and that OSHA could require vaccines at certain workplaces, but not nationwide. And
well,
the rational, sorry?
We're discussing actually a good deal of speculative generalizations as to what might or might not happen. But we also have several years of experience with this pandemic. So there must be a powerful accumulation of facts. How many correctional officers in which jobs have been infected and how many have not. And I haven't seen anywhere in anything that's been submitted any comparison, any collection of data, anything that could support your saying that this is a different kind of job. Where are the facts? How do we know this? If in fact the evidence shows that correctional officers are three times, not only more likely, but have three times as much infection, you'd have, I think, a different argument than the speculation that you're presenting to us.
Your Honor, it's a complaint. When we get into discovery, if you let us out of the gate, we will have those facts. We will show you that, as you point out, the correctional officers were three to five times more likely to get COVID-19.
You haven't even alleged that in your complaint, that there are several times whatever it is that you're going to prove. You're just telling us these people are different.
We are telling you.
And you see are concerned.
Your Honor, I
exposed.
It's Rule 8, a short, plain statement of the facts. We alleged everything that we had to allege in the complaint. We had to allege that they worked with in close proximity to the virulent biological, that it causes serious disease if you get it, and that there were no protective devices to take it, you know, to save you, and that it wasn't taken into account when they classified the position. We put all of that in the complaint.
This discussion proves the difficult line drawing that's involved here. And I don't hear an adequate response as to why the remedy isn't to go to OPM and say, this job is different, this job is sufficient to qualify them for hazard pay, and you should amend your regulation. Isn't OPM in a much better position to make those judgments than we are?
I would disagree, Your Honor. I think that you are in a position to make the decision about whether we have stated a claim for relief under the regulations as written. We can't make OPM do anything, but we have come into court, we have alleged all the elements of a hazardous duty pay claim and an environmental differential claim. If we could put on our proof, we will show you, Your Honor, that the workers were 3 to 5 times more likely to get this disease. We will show you that at FCI Danbury, it was an incubator of the coronavirus. We will show you, based on the COVID tracker, that in December of 2020, 97 inmates had active cases of COVID-19 inside that prison.
The government, in their brief, they pointed to the jungle duty category as an illustration of how OPM knows how to write a category that's directed to exposure to a particular disease and what happened, that someone should get extra pay when they're working in an environment that has something dangerous floating in the air. And that's unlike the virulent biological category, which doesn't have that kind of language. I saw another category called the asbestos category. And that category likewise talks very specifically about exposure to airborne concentrations of asbestos fibers in excess of the permissible exposure limits set out by an OSHA regulation. I'm wondering, what should we take away from this? Is this another contrasting example like the jungle duty example? Because here, again, OPM has shown that it's concerned when you're working in a particular environment where there's some kind of hazardous matter floating in the air, and they provided a category of extra pay for that, and they also provided something administrable, which is a certain exposure level that is set out by OSHA regulations. And I was wondering if you could speak to how we should think about this asbestos category as well as the jungle duty category.
Well, Your Honor, the asbestos category came about through an amendment, I think, of the statute in 2003. I don't believe that there needs to be any kind of further definition of exposure to virulent biologicals. I mean, it's in there already, and we have stated a claim for it. Now, with respect to the jungle duty, I think the jungle duty regulation actually supports us. The workers who are in the jungle are entitled to get hazardous duty pay if the roads are unsafe and if there's a potential they could be bitten by a snake. I mean, that's essentially what it says. The workers are not in the jungle.
You got the snakes and the panthers, right? But as a separate requirement or alternative, not requirement, is just exposure to diseases.
That is part of it. That's one of them. Exposure to diseases, bad roads, and the snakes. And the employees are not in that jungle in order to, you know, study the vegetation or to, you know, study the wildlife in the jungle. They're probably in there looking for drugs or the cartel or whatever it is in the jungle. And they don't have to get bitten by the snake in order to get hazardous duty pay. We don't have to get the disease. We don't have to fall off the roof. What we need in this situation, I think you asked one of these questions about what's the accident here. The accident is the exposure, the risk of exposure to this deadly airborne.
Counsel, do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Oh, I thought I did, yes.
Okay, no, this is all your time. But one quick question before you do, and I will restore your rebuttal time. Twice in response to Judge Reyna, who asked you if the OPM memo and guidance was in fact attached to your complaint, you said, yes, I think so. It's not actually, though, correct? I mean, you reference it at page 18, like you also reference additional guidance, you reference the WHO guidelines, but it wasn't actually attached to your complaint. Just for physical clarification purposes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Is that correct?
I believe that is correct, and to the extent, I don't think we attached anything to the complaint.
There was nothing attached to the complaint.
Right, and we don't usually attach things to our complaint because we usually get to prove our evidence through discovery.
Didn't, correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
And if you want us
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Congress passed the hazardous duty and environmental differential pay statutes in order to fill a gap and compensate general schedule and wage system employees who had been working side by side with military and public health service personnel who were themselves eligible to receive additional hazard-related compensation.
I understand the government's position about the meaning of these regulations, but does the government agree that under the statute for unusual hazards, OPM has the authority and discretion, if it wanted to add yet another category to both of these schedules that would encompass federal employees working in an environment where there is this very unusual hazard floating in the air?
Yes, I think the statute directly or expressly directs OPM to draft an appendix that lists the various duties that would be eligible for hazardous duty pay, and whether OPM would issue regulations that would affect such an enormous number of
I'm not saying they must, but I'm just asking, do you agree, does the government agree that they could, under the statute, that they have the authority under the statute to write a new category?
I think that's probably right, Your Honor. My only concern is that whether we start to encroach on the major questions doctrine about whether such an enormous sort of unfunded expenditure would have been contemplated by the Congress. But by the express terms of the statute.
You're certainly trying to carry the major questions doctrine to an extreme level. That's quite odd.
To be clear, I think the express provisions of the statute allow OPM to define what constitutes an unusual hazard. And so if OPM wanted to clarify that virulent biologicals includes, for instance, exposure to human beings who are incidentally infected with a communicable disease, they may be able to do that.
I assume it's correct that OPM has full information, statistical and also specific, as to which government employees have been infected in which job positions and which have not.
I don't think that's right, Your Honor. I think that
you don't think so.
No, Your Honor. I think that agencies are certainly encouraged to track SARS coronavirus 2 infections to the extent each individual institution or agency did so. It's not on the record, and I'm not aware of what the details are of that data.
Well, they can certainly gather it, right?
They can gather some data. I don't know exactly what extent whether or not Bureau of Prisons knows how many inmates have ever been infected in the last 2 or 3 years. They may know that. Whether they know the exact dates or where those inmates were at a particular time and date, that I don't know.
Well, you would think normally what you do is issue a notice of proposed rulemaking and say, we're proposing to add additional categories here, and then people would comment, they'd receive data, they make a judgment. That's the way it would usually be done.
I agree, Ron. And to be clear, I'm not denying that the statute permits OPM to amend the regulations. It does. Whether or not it would is just a different question, that's all.
Can I ask you this question? So I want to focus very specifically, I think, on Judge Dyke's thought, which I think is reflected in some of the other questions, too, that your statutory argument, to the extent you were making one, I gather you're not really making one now, that the unusual standard of the two statutes, would XSHAPE allow OPM to do something? And suppose I thought that the current regulatory standard, in particular the in proximity to language, was a little difficult for you, but that structurally the availability of relief from OPM by way of amendment was very, very important. What would be the doctrinal hook under which I would give decisive force in deciding how to interpret the in proximity to language based on the ability to go to OPM and get a an agency definition, perhaps even of retroactive ability, of retroactive effect for airborne viruses from human vectors.
So, Your Honor, are you suggesting in your hypothetical, I just want to clarify, that the plaintiffs would be unable to state a claim under the regulation as currently written?
If I'm trying to decide how to answer that question, and I'm thinking in proximity to favors them, doesn't favor you, it's a bit of a strain to make it favor you, but I might be persuaded to favor you in that interpretation if I was assured, if I thought it clear that OPM could in fact do something. What would be the doctrinal argument for building that into, as a decisive consideration, the interpretation of this phrase, which I think on its face is actually something of a challenge for you?
And I'd like to address that latter point in a moment, Your Honor. But I think that it's hard to conclude that because OPM is able to amend the regulations, that a plaintiff would be unable to state a claim under regulations as written. So the answer to your question may be that there is not a specific doctrinal hook, as you described it, that would permit or that the court could point to and say, because OPM is allowed to amend regulations and there are problems with the enclosed proximity to language, that the plaintiffs either have to file an amended complaint or fail to state a claim based on the complaint as written.
Okay, and I'm actually interested in one question, which I guess is related in my mind. Why shouldn't we give our deference to the OPM March 7th, 2020 pronouncements?
Well, I don't think that it's not a rule to the extent that there was no notice and comment with regard to the memo that was drafted in March. I think more importantly, when you take a step back, certainly the March 7th memo is one.
Is your current position contrary to or consistent with that memo?
It's consistent with that memo, and so the memo, as stated, asks the question, as Judge Reyna pointed out, may an employee who has been exposed incidentally to COVID-19, i.e. in a manner not directly associated with the performance of assigned duties, receive a hazard pay differential for exposure to variant biologicals? The memo answers no. That's the first word. Separately, in the fourth part of that Q&A, it says, can employers receive hazardous duty pay or environmental differential pay for potential exposure to COVID-19? OPM similarly replied, no, which is in direct contravention to the plaintiff's theory of this case, which is that mere potential exposure would permit the plaintiffs in this case to recover under the HDP statutes. But more importantly, if the court were to look at OPM guidance, this certainly is one thing that can color the decision as to how the regulations should be interpreted. But there's an even more important and relevant guidance from OPM, and that is the Federal Personnel Manual, which was issued contemporaneously with these very regulations that are at issue here. So in 1969, when the regulations were issued, OPM, at the time the Civil Service Commission, issued the Federal Personnel Manual, which gave color to what it means to work with or in close proximity to virulent biologicals. And what OPM said at that time was, examples like operating or maintaining equipment in biological experimentation and production, cleaning and sterilization of vessels and equipment contaminated with virulent microorganisms. The type of duty that is targeted toward the specific virulent biological, not merely working in an office or somewhere close by human beings who are incidentally or potentially infected with a virulent biological.
Opposing counsel seems to contend you're saying there's like a scientist rule. Who else do you think gets relief besides scientists or something like that?
There's two things to that, Judge Cunningham. First of all, it's not a scientist rule. It's not restricted to only scientists who work in laboratory. We gave one example in our brief specific to potentially the Federal Correctional Institution's situation. But, I can imagine a situation where there's a biosafety level 3 or 4, which is a very high level dangerous lab, that a centrifuge may be broken and a centrifuge technician needs to be called in into this dangerous laboratory and just to repair the centrifuge. They're not a scientist, they're not working with petri dishes or flasks, but they're directed, assigned specifically to go into this dangerous laboratory and perform his or her work. And
so if a custodian's job is just to mop floors in a lab with dangerous stuff around, not, you know, he's there despite the dangerous stuff, he's not covered in your view?
I think it depends on what the job duties specifically are. So
Watch the floors.
Certainly, but if an agency, if you know, Fort Detrick hires a janitor to specifically mop the floors in these dangerous BSL 3 and 4 laboratories, then maybe they would be entitled to it. And also, alternatively, if there was a janitor who...
I want to try to get something beyond a maybe. Because you're suggesting a line whose meaning is not clear to me, and yet it is the central submission you make about how to interpret this phrase. And the fuzzier and more uncertain your line, the harder it is to attribute it to words that don't seem to embody it.
Sure, and to be clear, and this is why we note in our brief repeatedly that the touchstone for the test is whether the focus of the assigned duties is actually the virulent biological or the microorganism. So in the case of the plaintiffs here, the assigned duty is, as they describe, escorting prisoners, keeping the prison safe, etc. It's not working with the virulent biological. So, for example, if a janitor who had never typically worked in a laboratory was working in, you know, some other office space and was told, look, there's a spill or this, you know, someone spilled Coke or something, not a virulent biological, all over this very dangerous lab floor, we want you to go in specifically to that lab.
So, I think what you just said is it makes a difference whether it's intermittent, and we know that's not in the statute or the regulation.
No, not intermittent. It's a question whether the assigned, whether the virulent...
It's the wash floors in this building, and sometimes portions of the rooms containing those floors are going to create a danger of exposure.
If the employer directs the janitor in your situation to specifically clean the floors in the location that they know that the virulent biological or microorganism...
Why does knowledge have anything to do with it?
Well, because it becomes the focus of the assignment.
I'm sorry, that person is working in close proximity to a virulent biological. Might be in a petri dish. Let's assume it's in a petri dish. Not there for the purpose of working with the petri dish, but he sure is in close proximity to it. How does the language of the two regulations not apply to that?
So I think it may if the employee was directed to work specifically with the biosafety level 4 or 3 microorganisms. So it's not simply a question of was I mopping the floor and there was something in the air. There has to be something more than that. And I'll explain why by bringing back to the regulations here.
Would that have to be decided on a case-by-case basis?
Not in this case, Your Honor.
By the agencies?
No, Your Honor. And in this case, the plaintiff failed to state a claim based on the language in the regulation. And so
I'm going back to this OPM guidance, and I rechecked. It wasn't attached, but it's cited, and it's cited in the complaint. And it does say in that same paragraph I was looking at before, it says, OPM does not determine when hazard pay differences must be paid. Agencies have the responsibility and are in the best position to determine whether the duties performed by employees meet the regulatory requirements. Thus, agency managers, in consultation with occupational safety and health experts, must determine whether an employee is entitled to hazard pay on a case-by-case basis. I would imagine that's because there's so many different factual scenarios out there in the field of federal employment. But so in that connection, let me ask you, did any federal agencies, other than forget about the Bureau of Prisons, any federal agencies pay HDP and EDP pay with respect to COVID?
I'm aware of the Indian Health Service providing for HDP for anyone who is physically working at a health station, clinic, or hospital for a brief amount of time during the pandemic. I'm not aware if there are other agencies that did so.
That's the Department of Health and Human Services, right?
Interior.
The Indian Health Service, I believe it is. I think that's right, Your Honor.
So they did pay with respect to COVID-19 hazardous pay to some employees?
to certain ones physically working at a health station, clinic, or hospital, so essentially healthcare workers.
And do you know of any other agencies that also made determine that their employees were entitled to hazardous pay?
I don't know of any, Your Honor. There may be. I'm not sure.
Okay, thank you.
Are you aware of whether Interior did that?
I'm sorry?
Are you aware of whether the Interior Department did that?
I just don't know. I don't know, Your Honor.
I just wanted to follow up on that. So let's just take two hypotheticals. The first hypothetical is a doctor is working with a petri dish with COVID in it, trying to come up with a cure. That would fall under the biologic regulatory language, wouldn't it?
Assuming that their job description did not specifically include working with the hazard, then it could be compensable, yes.
Okay. So now, suppose instead that same doctor is working in a COVID ward. They're actually working in a federal hospital, like an NIH-type facility or a federal hospital, where they're being asked to care for people who are dying of COVID. Is that covered by the biologic regulation?
So, again, assuming that the doctor's job description doesn't include or provide for exposure to the types of virulent biologicals, and his bosses or the agency said, I'm directing you specifically to go work in the COVID unit, potentially, for the same reason that bringing it back to the laboratory example or the so-called scientist rule, you know, there may be scientists who work in a laboratory but don't work with virulent biologicals. They work with something, you know, much less dangerous or not dangerous at all. And I can imagine a scenario where in an emergency situation, a lab that required someone with specific knowledge, skills, and ability to come in and work with something that was specifically dangerous. So there may be a lab technician who never works with Ebola who, for whatever reason, is specifically assigned, go into that lab.
My hypothetical wasn't a lab, right? It was a hospital or
right.
A COVID ward. You know, I just wanted to see, I was trying to understand if you believe there's a difference between a biologic contained in a vessel of the form of a petri dish or a biologic contained in a vessel in the form of a human being. That's what I'm trying to understand. And you answered my hypothetical that yes, in both of those cases, under the limitations you articulated, hazardous duty pay could be available.
Yes, so clearly, as we described in our brief, the human beings are not containers, and so for the reason that we described in the brief, that they wouldn't be eligible based on that. I was relying on the assumption.
What wouldn't be eligible based on that? The doctors who worked with the human beings in the COVID ward would not be eligible for hazardous duty pay, either under either of the two statutes or sets of regulations.
They wouldn't be eligible for EDP because people are containers. That's not what I'm saying. The keystone here is whether they were assigned specifically to work with the virulent biologic.
So they would not be eligible for EDP because humans aren't containers. Is that your argument? I just want to make sure I'm understanding you.
No, I apologize for being a little bit unclear. It's not because human beings are containers that they could be eligible for EDP. Rather, we have noted that human beings are not containers. They may be eligible for EDP. They're not wage system employees, but you know, EDP or HDP if they were specifically assigned to deal with the virulent biological. So it would be really the HDP.
What does that mean? Are you saying that if they were exposed in the ICU? To people with COVID that they could get hazard duty pay?
Potential exposure is not enough. What is required, again, to bring it back to the regulations, the HDP regulations at section 550.
What I'm trying to get at is there a situation in which human-to-human contact could lead to exposure to a biologic that would entitle them to hazardous duty pay?
There may be a narrow set of circumstances. We gave one example in our brief where the prison worker is actually taking swabs of infected inmates. They were directed to do so. It wasn't part of their ordinary job responsibilities in the sense that they're not a healthcare worker, et cetera. So that would be an example where they might be able to be eligible for HDP because they're working with a person and not a flask or a petri dish.
Well, I keep coming back to the same problem. Because of all of it, we say there may be, and yet you say that we don't know. We don't know whether healthcare workers have a higher infection rate or others. We don't know any of these things despite the powerful experience that the nation has had the last 3 years with this virus.
Judge, I'm not trying to dodge the hypotheticals, but rather there's a key part of the question that we were not sort of talking about, which is that in the regulations, Section 904 says that an agency shall pay the hazard pay differential listed in Appendix A of the subpart to an employee who is assigned to and performs any duty specified in Appendix A. And in Appendix A, the virulent biologicals category is part of a broader category called exposure to hazardous agents, and that requires specifically work with or in close proximity to a virulent biological. So an employee must be assigned to work with or in close proximity to the biological itself. And the reason why this language is important is it differs from other hazards in the HDP regulations. For example, one of the hazards is exposure to hazardous weather or terrain where work or travel in sparsely settled or isolated areas results in exposure to temperatures or wind velocity shown to be of considerable danger. In that situation, the regulations contemplate an employee doing their ordinary job responsibilities, traveling from one place to another in a sparsely settled area. And if a hazard such as very dangerous wind or temperature conditions arises, they would be eligible for HDP. Unlike those regulations, the virulent biological regulation specifically requires working with or in close proximity to the virulent biological, not to someone who is potentially infected. So they have to be assigned to and work with. That's why.
So you're saying now, I'm still back to the chief's question and what your answer was and Judge Dyke's follow-up. You're saying person to person, even if it's working in an infirmary, doesn't count, but if that person is exposed to the swab, a swab taken from one of the people in the infirmary, then that would be covered?
No, what I'm saying is that it would be covered provided that the healthcare worker was specifically directed to work with or in close proximity to the virulent biological. So if you took a nurse, for example, who was working perhaps in a radiology unit, doesn't work with on the ICU or work with other patients on a regular basis, and they say to her, "We're short-staffed. We need to put you in the COVID unit. You're going to be working directly with these people. You're going to help, intubate them, et cetera." Then, yes, that healthcare worker would be eligible for HDP.
So that would include someone in a prison environment who's assigned to work in the infirmary with COVID-infected patients.
No, because if they're normally performing the ordinary job responsibilities, which is what is alleged in this case, which is that they are escorting prisoners, handcuffing them, searching them, et cetera, they're not specifically assigned to work with the virulent biological. They're specifically assigned to do their everyday job responsibilities.
Respectfully, prior to 2020, none of these people you're describing had as part of their position description work with people with COVID. So while a nurse may have worked in the ICU with people who just experienced a heart attack or other sorts of medical conditions, her job description wouldn't have said, "Work with people with this disease for which we have no cure and you might die and there's no vaccine."
Certainly, right?
So it can't just be whether she worked with patients. The job had to have had the expectation upon her hiring that her pay already included this hazard, working with COVID people.
Certainly, Your Honor. I mean, part of the problem with the hypothetical of the medical professional is that very frequently their job descriptions would include, being exposed to biological contamination from individuals. But in this case, it's key to remember that this is not the first epidemic or pandemic that this country has ever encountered. Airborne communicable diseases and outbreaks of them in prisons occur all the time, whether it's tuberculosis.
Sir, are you suggesting that the COVID situation that we've been going through is kind of like a normal flu, seasonal flu? Or are you accepting what other parts of the government have been saying loudly and for 2.5 years, that this is a highly unusual version of contagious diseases, worse than anything we've seen, I don't know, pick 1918 or 1967 or 8 or whatever? I mean, why is that not enough to be unusual?
Because it doesn't meet the specific regulatory language.
Okay, so let's forget about unusual. Some of what you've been saying, and I've been trying to get to think of where this subject of the assigned duty sounds like a distinction that appears in certain discrimination law about the difference between doing something because of or in spite of. Are you suggesting that the exposure has to be because of the presence, that is, the The proximity has to be specifically because of the assignment of being in a place in which you are near has to be chosen by the assigner because of the nearness, but not simply because you've been assigned a duty that happens to put you near a disease vector.
The second part of what you said is definitely correct, Your Honor. I think that the first part also is as well. What I'm saying is that based on the regulatory language in Section 904, which says an employee is eligible for HDP when they are assigned to and perform the hazard.
It sounds like the distinction you're making, and I guess I'm having some trouble getting it out of language that has nothing to do with intent at all, which is a matter, which is, you know, where this comes from in discrimination law. It just says the duty that you're assigned to puts you near this bad stuff.
The focus of the assignment has to be specifically the virulent biological. So it's not incidental.
You keep saying that, and I'm trying to understand, and you keep jumping over the crucial thing is, how do you justify that translation of words that don't say that into this concept under which you win?
Because the regulations say assign, I'll take it part by bit by bit, the regulations say assigned to work with a virulent biological.
No, they don't. They say assigned to work with or be in close proximity to.
Right. I was going to get to that in a moment, Your Honor. But so for in that example, I think it's pretty clear that when the regulations require an employee to be assigned to work with a virulent biological, it doesn't mean work near someone who's infected.
I will, as they say, spot you that half of it. It's the other half that's a concern, right?
Sure. And so, in this case, the working with, and this brings us back to this court's decision in Adair. What does it mean to be assigned to work in close proximity to a virulent biological? And that is where this court's decision in Adair comes into place, and that comes into play. And
it's also, let me ask you this question then, and just to kind of sum up all the different hypotheticals we've been having. And you tell me if this is correct or not, this statement I'm about to make, that there are circumstances when a correctional officer can be entitled to hazardous pay.
Yes.
Thank you.
And to get back to what I was saying a moment ago, the Adair case talks about what it means to work with or in close proximity to a virulent biological. And that's also where the examples in the guidance in the Federal Personnel Manual come into play. So when we're talking about, the court has to determine what it means to work in close proximity to a virulent biological, not what it means to work in close proximity to someone who's infected. And so when you look at the regulations, you look at the history of the regulations, the guidance that was issued, this court's decision of there, it was clear that the court focused on the types of tasks that were at issue there. Cleaning sterilized infants, working with petri dishes, working with flasks. That's the kind of stuff that we're talking about working in close proximity to something means, not simply incidentally being exposed to someone who is infected.
I find your distinctions somewhat incoherent. Is your position that human-to-human contact that's required as part of the job can lead to exposure to biologics and to compensation?
I think that I would need more information about hypothetical, Your Honor. Is it possible, is there any situation which being near another individual could give rise, potentially? But I think that I need more information.
That's the problem. We have to draw lines here, and it's not clear what the line is that you would have us draw. I can understand a line that says regulations not devoted to human-to-human exposure, and you need a new regulation to reach that, but you don't seem to be saying that.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that your question highlights the problem with the plaintiff's theory in this case. They're unable to articulate any limiting principle to a reimbursement or compensation for working in close proximity to anyone with a communicable disease.
I hate to say this, but I kind of share Judge Dyke's summation of your position. And I'm really troubled. I thought the government's position, and I must now be wrong, but I thought the government's position on the regulatory interpretation was that when it says working with or in close proximity to a poison or a biologic, that did not include working in or in close proximity to a human that happens to be sick. I thought I understood the government's regulatory interpretation to draw a line, which is what we have to do in interpreting this provision, but you seem to have gone all over the place on this question. Do you not draw that line? Is your view, as you stand here in the final 22 seconds of your argument, the government has not drawn a line that says that this regulation as written does not include human-to-human exposure?
The regulation as written, certainly as applied to all of the plaintiffs that we've been talking about here, it does not apply to individuals who happen to be or may be infected with any communicable disease. So Your Honor is right that we are not stating that exposure to individual people who may be infected is sufficient.
What about individual people who are infected?
No, because it's not contemplated by the regulations. The regulations contemplate working with or in close proximity to the virulent biological, not a person who happens to be infected. And again, that's where the Adair case talks about
Why did you preface your answer to that question with the people we're talking about here it doesn't apply to?
Because it's key to this case, Your Honor, and not just this case, but also the other cases that we mentioned in our brief, the class action that involves, you know, people who are walking down the street checking license plates or going into a crowded convenience store where they're alleging that they're entitled to hazard pay for being near human beings, other people who may or may not be infected. And for that reason, that's why we're saying in those situations, they're clearly not available. The HDP and EDP civilian pay is not available in those situations.
Counsel, just to clarify, are you then changing the answer to your question about whether medical professionals who are treating patients with COVID fall under this definition? Because I thought you said earlier that they did.
I think it ultimately depends on both the job description and exactly the tasks that are involved.
Is it a yes or a no?
I'm not changing my answer, Your Honor, because there may potentially be a situation where it's qualitatively different to say a healthcare worker who's going in and specifically directed to work with SARS coronavirus 2, they may be entitled to
A patient who has it.
Well, I think that depending on the situation, they may be entitled to it. But
can you just identify what would be the situation where a medical professional or any federal employee was interacting with a COVID-infected patient that would qualify for hazard duty pay under virulent biologicals, aside from doing the swab test? Is there anything else? Are there other circumstances?
So if we're going to assume away all of the restrictions about the job classification.
It's outside their normal duties as described in their, you know, job description.
I think potentially if a nurse was, the example I gave was working in a radiology department, never worked with directly with people not working with people in a radiology department, was assigned specifically to work with someone in the ICU who was intubating someone who's dying of COVID and has enormous amounts of COVID as being admitted as part of the intubation process, a protocol. It's an example like that where they're specifically assigned to do that for COVID, not just randomly.
To participate
in intubation. So as some of us may have read, when intubating someone who's very sick with COVID.
Is that because the exposure is going to be to the virus and the bodily fluids rather than just person-to-person exposure?
Well, I'm not sure if what the distinction is between person-to-person versus bodily fluid.
Honestly a little confused, too, why you're not just saying person-to-person exposure is not contemplated by these things because it actually requires exposure to the underlying virus.
Well,
I mean, I know you're trying to not foreclose a reading that would give benefits to people in the future if they come up with a better argument, but it's certainly kind of making us unsure of where to draw the line. And I get you only want to talk about this case, but we're sitting on bonk to interpret a regulation. We're going to draw lines. What line do you want us to draw here?
Well, the line is an employee is not eligible for HDP or EDP based on working with anyone who happens to be infected. So when they're performing their ordinary job responsibilities, like searching someone or working in an office or checking license plates, and they happen to be near someone who is infected, that is qualitatively different than being directed to work with a virulent biological, either directly.
What about being directed to oversee, you know, and potentially touch and grab somebody who has COVID? I mean, that's the hypothetical that I think we're being asked to address today.
Well, I think Judge Hughes is right that the plaintiffs or an employee has to allege that they were working with the virus itself, and so not exactly with someone who was, maybe that's a better way of stating it, working with the virus itself versus working with someone who was infected with it.
But the statute says close proximity. It's not just limited to working with the virus alone. It's being in close proximity to it also, correct?
Correct, but that's why the Adair case sheds light on this issue about what it means to work in close proximity to. The examples in the Federal Personnel Manual give color to what it means to work with, I mean, in close proximity. In Adair, the question was whether environmental tobacco smoke contained toxic chemicals. There was no dispute that there was smoke in the air all the time, right? In some sense, analogous to whether the coronavirus was in the air. If all it took was for it to be in the air and someone to be in the room, then the Adair case should have been decided differently. I know that this case is sitting on bonk and can overrule it, but the logic of what it means to work with or in close proximity to applies equally here, that the types of tasks that OPM was intending to cover is not simply being in a place where it happens to be in the air. It has to be specifically working with or in close proximity to the virus itself.
Okay, counsel, we've exceeded your time. Thank you very much. Ms. Elkin, I'll restore your 8 minutes of requested rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honors. The government's argument makes plain that there's no meaningful difference between working with a vial of coronavirus or working with a human with coronavirus. And in the context of these prison workers, if you want a line, I mean, this is the case to draw the line. These workers, like I said, will be able to prove where they were assigned on a day-by-day basis because the United States Bureau of Prisons keeps track of that. They will be able to prove on a day-by-day basis.
We have to tell you to go amend your complaint. We can't draw the line here because all the things that you want us to base the line on don't exist in your complaint. And so if we overturned the dismissal here, it would open the floodgates to anybody in any job with any exposure. So all the stuff you've alleged is not in your complaint. So this isn't the case. The best argument you could make there, if your argument really is that the prison guards are special, is give us a chance to amend the complaint to show you that, and then this is the case.
Your Honor, if that's, again, we believe that our complaint is well pled.
It's not.
Well, we can amend the complaint, and we can submit a complaint that talks about how these workers worked in close proximity, something that the government seems to ignore in the regulation, to the coronavirus. In before times, when they had to work with the inmates and escort them and feed them and transport them, that was their job. Now, or during the pandemic, before vaccines, their job was to transport, feed, and escort inmates who were infected with coronavirus. The rest of us were in the basement. We were in the basement. These are the workers who can and did state a claim for relief under their well-pled complaint. And if you're worried about the floodgates, you have tools at your disposal to draw the line. And the limitations.
Suppose you have an NIH lab that's working on flu, and somebody is exposed to the flu. Do they get hazardous duty pay under this regulation?
No, Your Honor. There's nothing.
No, what's the difference between the flu and COVID in terms of the regulatory language?
It's the virulent biological is defined as something that is going to get you really sick or kill you, and there's no protections for it. The flu for I don't know how many years, a half a century, we've had vaccines. We've had flu outbreaks in prisons all the time. We're not in this courtroom looking for COVID pay, hazardous duty pay for the flu. The flu is not unusual. There's nothing unusual about it. COVID-19, when you're just considering whether there's anything unusual about this, get in your time machines and park them in front of March of 2020.
Where does the regulation say that it has to be an unusual biologic?
The statute says it has to be an unusual hazard, and the regulation says a virulent biological is something that when it gets in you, it's going to get you, it's likely to cause serious illness or it could kill you. The flu is not that. And so when you're considering whether it's unusual.
30,000 people a year die from.
Your Honor, it doesn't meet the definition. I don't know a plaintiff lawyer in the country who would come in here and try to get hazardous duty pay for the flu. But when you were considering if there's anything unusual or different about the COVID, go in your time machines, park them in front of March 2020 when there were ventilators, not enough going around. There were refrigeration trucks parked outside of every overcrowded hospital in this country. When we were all at home, when the schools were closed, when there were no funerals, when people died in hospitals alone, when there were no funerals, when there were no, let me just, when there were no funerals, there were no graduations, there were no weddings, there was, we didn't do these things. Every single rite of passage passed without anybody to mark them. This was unusual. The flu is not like that. We're not coming in the courtroom asking for hazardous duty pay for the flu. We are coming in the courtroom with these specific workers who worked locked inside a prison.
I think I've got that point. Can I ask you, why should the regulation not be interpreted to limit the in close proximity language to situations in which the presence of the microorganism is the reason for the employee's presence in the area?
Your Honor, because it would be inconsistent with the statute. The statute does not say that the virulent biological has to be the focus of the work. The government is wrong on that point. Instead, the statute says an employee is entitled to be paid the appropriate differential for any period in which he is subjected. He is subjected to the physical hardship or hazard not usually involved in carrying out the duties of his job. That is exactly what we have here. They went into the storm, into the unprecedented storm, where it rained down virulent biologicals on them, it rained down microorganisms on them, and they went into that storm without the protection of a raincoat or an umbrella. These are the workers who are entitled to this hazardous duty pay. You don't have to look beyond the plain language of the...
Did they have masks or anything?
Sorry?
You just mentioned no raincoat, no umbrella. They had no mask, they had no PPE.
If you'll remember, you're parking that time machine in front of March of 2020, hospital workers didn't have masks. We were at home knitting masks. So to the extent they even have masks, we all know from science, which we're allowed to put on our case, masks didn't stop the pandemic from spreading from human vessel to human vessel, which is how we spread this disease. We shed it, we cough, we walk, we talk. That's exactly what's happening in these overcrowded prisons. These workers had no choice but to go and work in these overcrowded prisons.
You bring up an interesting point when you say get in your time machine. With respect to our jurisprudence on pleading, and because of the ease in employing hindsight, sitting here in 2022, looking back, and you know, we're all, well, there's people here wearing masks, but at one time, you know, so what period do we look at in terms of the complaint? Is it when the complaint was filed, or is it the way conditions are now?
Your Honor, that's an excellent question, and I believe that the answer is we have stated a claim for relief based on the regulations and the statute up through from the start of the pandemic up through the date that vaccines were readily available. And after that time, we don't meet the definition anymore because it's the flu. Okay? So we can limit this. We can get this right when we put on our case in the lower court. Please send us back there. Let us put on our case. If there were ever a group of workers entitled to this type of pay that Congress put on the books for working under, performing your regular job duties under unusually severe or hazardous conditions, these are the workers. Go back in time one more time to New York City with all of the residents hanging out their windows, banging on their pots and pans at 7 o'clock at night, cheering on the first line responders, and compare that. Compare that, please, to the United States position here.
Hey, over here.
Sorry.
Does your theory include both potential exposure and actual exposure, or just one or the other? I'm trying to just make sure I understand what you're saying.
And your Honor?
New York and all the places.
Okay, so I'm going to go back to New York in a minute, but it includes both. It includes both potential exposure and actual exposure. But the key here is that the plaintiff, whatever plaintiff comes in this court, has to prove that there was a sick person or that there was an infectious person. The potential exposure is the guy on the roof, right? In the example, he doesn't have to fall off the roof to get the pay. We don't have to show that we were actually exposed in order to get the pay. What we have to show is that the correctional officer was assigned to a position where he was either guarding, feeding, working with an inmate who had infection, which we will be able to show based on the assignment data, and the incredibly good job the government did in terms of tracking who was sick in these prisons.
Thank you, Ms. Elkin. Your time is up. We take this case under submission.